No, you're fine. Next week, yeah, I'm meeting you halfway. Working my way back. Hello. No, you don't need to move back. That's fine. You can look at me. Give me side view angles here. All right, I'm meeting y'all halfway. I'm coming back this far. And then next week I'll be back there. So if y'all want to sit up here, you can sit up here, but you'll be listening to the back of my head. All right. We're in the book of Isaiah. And we're in chapter 5. So if you'd be turning to that place. And we're going to begin about the 8th verse. I talked briefly last week, and I'm not going to really make more mention of this than I will. But the first 7 verses, God talks about a vineyard. He talks about a vineyard that he built. He talks about how he set it up and how he planted it with the choicest vines, how he built a tower, how he took care of it. He expects it to produce good grapes, but it produces only worthless grapes. And so we know from this that he's going to remove the hedge that he put around it. It's going to be consumed. He's going to break down the wall. It's going to be trampled. He'll lay it to waste. It will not be pruned or hoed. Briars and thorns will come up, and he will charge the clouds to rain on it no more. He then tells us in verse 7 that the vineyard is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are the delightful plant, that he looked for justice and beheld only bloodshed, for righteousness, but beheld only a cry of distress. So after this general warning that he presents to the house of Judah and to Jerusalem in verses 1 through 7, he then begins to talk about the 6 woes. And we want to focus on that just briefly this morning, because we're supposed to be, according to our outline, we're supposed to be in chapter 6. So I've got to accomplish the rest of chapter 5 and then get us through chapter 6, which, by the way, brings us to next week. And for next week, your reading assignment for next week should be chapter 7 through 10. And that begins the large portion of the messianic prophecies concerning Christ's coming. So 7 through 10 for next week, if you would please, to read those and then be ready to participate. Beginning in verse 8 of Isaiah 5. Woe to those who add house to house and join field to field until there is no more room, so that you have to live alone in the midst of the land. In my ears, the Lord of hosts has sworn, surely many houses shall become desolate, even great and fine ones without occupants. For 10 acres of vineyard will yield only 1 bath of wine, and a homer of seed will yield but an epeth of grain. All right, that's the first woe. So what is he talking about here? What's he talking about with this particular woe? What's the single word that you could use to describe what he's talking about here? I'm sorry? Not really famine. We're talking about woes, so he's talking about the sins of the people. What is the sin that he's talking about here? The sin of what? Not necessarily greed. There is greed involved in this, but it's the sin of covetousness. It's the sin of covetousness. And what is covetousness? What is covetousness? Desiring something that someone else has, or wanting something for having to pay nothing for it. Right. So the story comes to mind for me that the first winner of the Florida lottery, when they put the lottery in place in Florida, the first winner of the Florida lottery was an elder in the church. The book of Colossians tells us that covetousness is idolatry. And so for that reason, I don't play the lottery. Now, Brother Raymer works with Corvettes, and the museum always has a Corvette that's up for you. Buy $20 and you might have a chance to win a Corvette. Well, I have some problems with that. I'd love to be driving the new Corvette, but I don't know that I'd want to do that. That's wanting something that's of a price with you not having to put anything to it, or there, you know, to know doesn't cost you anything. And by the way, Linda, where are those handouts that we had from last week? I'm sorry. On the front pew? Okay. If I can get somebody to... Andy, can you help me with this? I'm sorry. This is an afterthought. This was supposed to be to you a couple weeks ago. These are the handouts of the PDFs for the class that you can carry and bring with you each time, because as we talk about the different lands and everything, these are all the things that you need to know. So, okay, so we're talking about...
The museum is a nonprofit.
Oh, it's a nonprofit. Okay, so I'm buying a ticket this afternoon. I'm buying a ticket today. But I'm not playing the lottery. Okay. So what we're talking about here is covetousness. So these people in this particular period of time, and Uzziah, if you read about Uzziah in 2 Chronicles, he was one of the ones that expanded his lands. This is buying more land, adding house to house, making your house bigger, buying more land, talking about, adding vineyards and acreage to all of this. And it says, you know, those who join house to house, join field to field till there's no more room. They've bought up all the land. There's no more land for people to live on. But these people live alone in the midst of their land. They want to be separated from their neighbors. And this is something that we've seen down through time. And so the Lord says, surely many houses shall become desolate, even great and fine ones. So these houses are going to come to naught. This covetousness that these people, this greed that these people have is insatiable. And this greed is going to end according to God. And you see in verse 10, you know, there's a lot of strange words in verse 10 that you probably, if you haven't looked them up or studying them, are odd to you. But let me clarify those to you just to give you the import of this. In verse 10, it says, for 10 acres of vineyard will yield only one bath of wine. All right. So if we look back in Roman times and do a little calculation, in Roman times, 10 acres of vineyard would yield about 8,000 gallons of wine. Okay, so that's the typical Roman 10 acres of vineyard would yield about 8,000 gallons of wine. And what he's saying here is 10 acres of vineyard will yield about 8 gallons. So he's going to lay the vineyards desolate. 8,000 gallons is what they would normally produce. He's going to say, now it's going to produce only about 8,000, or only going to produce about 8 gallons, if I said that something. It was supposed to produce about 8,000 gallons per 10 acres. Now he's saying it's going to produce 8 gallons. 8 gallons of wine out of 10 acres. So he's laying it desolate. And again, a homer of seed will yield but an epeth of grain. Now that one was a little more difficult to understand. It's a tenth part. An epeth is a tenth part of a homer. And if you want to use a reference there, it's Ezekiel 45, verse 11. And so the corn that would grow in the land, or the crops that would grow in the land, would only return a tenth of the seed that was sown on them. So that's what he's talking about here. So basically, the vineyards are going to be full of worthless grapes or not contain any grapes at all, and the fields are only going to yield a tenth of what they would normally yield. Okay? So, if a man will not work, neither will he eat. 2 Thessalonians 3 and 10. Labor in and of itself produces wealth. And those who work the hardest naturally acquire the most. The idle cannot complain if they have few of this world's goods since they make no effort to obtain them. And so he's talking about those who are adding to their fields at the expense of others. This will stop, he says. And their fields and their fields will become useless. Their vineyards will become useless. So, verse 11. Woe to those who rise early in the morning that they may pursue strong drink, who stay up late in the evening that wine may inflame them. And their banquets are accompanied by lyre and harp, by tambourine and flute, and by wine. But they do not pay attention to the deeds of the Lord, nor do they consider the work of his hands. Therefore my people shall go into exile for their lack of knowledge, and their honorable men are famished, and their multitude is parched with thirst. Therefore Sheol has enlarged its throat and opened its mouth without measure, and Jerusalem's splendor, her multitude, her den of revelry, and the jubilant within her, they all descend into it, so that the common man will be humbled, and the man of importance abased. The eyes of the proud will also be abased, but the Lord of hosts will be exalted in judgment, and the holy God will show himself holy in righteousness. Then the lambs will graze as in their pasture, and strangers shall eat in the waste places of the wealthy. This is the second woe. And so when we look at the second woe, we look at something that is very prevalent in today's society, especially during this time of pandemic, and this is drunkenness. I don't know that you want me to quote statistics for you, but I have them readily at hand. I think all of us realize that drunkenness, especially in the time of pandemic, has increased disproportionately. More people are isolated, more people are alone, and so drunkenness, drug use, suicide, all of these things have become very prevalent within the last year. So drunkenness and revelry is what he's talking to, is what he's talking about here. And he's not just addressing this to the people. Even the priests are drinking this strong drink. They're swallowed up with wine. He talks about that in Isaiah 28, verse 7. These banquets that they rise up early in the morning, these feasts, these celebrations start early in the morning. The princes and the nobles would begin feasting at a very early hour, Ecclesiastes 10, verse 10. And they would accompany themselves with music. It talks some about that in Amos 6, verses 5 and 6. These things continued into the night and terminated in general drunkenness and perhaps leading to general licentiousness among these people. Two kinds of intoxicating liquor are consumed at these banquets. One is the ordinary grape wine that is produced, but then there's the one he talks about here, which is called strong drink. And strong drink is called shikar, which is S-H-E-K-A-R. Shikar, it is a much stronger drink made of dates, pomegranate, apples, honey, barley, and other ingredients. And this is what is called strong drink. If you have the authorized version of the Bible, it calls this, in this case, it calls it strong drink in the American Standard. So this is strong drink. The wine inflames them. And again, this leads to that licentiousness. And so the common man here is humbled. That they play these musical instruments. It's often hard to find analogies with the Hebrew instruments of music and correlate that to modern instruments. But there is no doubting that the harp was a lot like what we would see today. The other instruments that they use, the tambourine, the flute. They don't pay attention to the deeds of the Lord. And so they've gone into captivity, or they will go into captivity. And so when the people go into captivity, they're taken over. They're taken over by the wine. They're taken over by the revelry. They're taken over by the music. They're unaware of what they're doing because the drink takes hold of them so strongly. And so hell has enlarged itself, verse 14. They'll go into exile, verse 13, for their lack of knowledge. They'll be taken captive, as he talks more about at the end of chapter 6 that we'll see later today. So in verse 14, he talks about Sheol, and when we talk about Sheol, we're talking about Hades, the realm of the dead. If you read Luke 16, there's two components to Hades, and what this is saying is that there are so many people that Sheol is going to enlarge its throat and open its mouth without measure. There's going to be so many people that are going to fall prey to this that hell's doors are going to be enlarged and widened without measure. Jerusalem's splendor, the multitude, her den of revelry, the jubilant within her, they're all going to descend in it. And so the common man, as well as the wealthy, are all going to be brought down. They're going to be brought into this captivity. But interestingly enough, in verse 16, God will be exalted in judgment. All of this will happen, and God will be exalted in judgment, and the holy God will show himself in righteousness. And then there's another allusion to, in verse 17, the lambs who will graze as in their pastures. And what are we talking about here? We've already mentioned this once before in the early portion of Isaiah. What are we talking about? The lambs grazing. Any ideas? Remember that remnant of the people, that righteous remnant that remains, that righteous remnant of the seed line of Christ that's always gone along. These are the lambs. These are the lambs that will graze in their pastures. The others, these that have added house to house and land to land, their end will be that strangers will eat in the waste places. So people like those that come in and forage in the wasteland of what's left of these pastures, what's left of these fields that are yielding these small crops, strangers are going to come in and they're going to eat in the waste places of the wealthy because they'll be taken captive. They'll be gone. Okay. So verse 18 is the third woe. Woe to those who drag iniquity with the cords of falsehood and sin as if it were cart ropes, who say, let him make speed, let him hasten his work that we may see it, and let the purposes of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come to pass that we may know it. Any ideas about the third woe? All right. This is a woe pronounced on those who openly pile sin upon sin and then scoff at God. These men are represented in the scriptures as drawing iniquity with cords of vanity. In other words, if you, in your mind's eye, if you can picture someone with a huge, all of their sin is in a huge bag, and they're dragging this bag behind them. They're dragging the burden of their sin behind them. Literally dragging this along. They're dragging their iniquity with cords of falsehood and sin as if it were cart ropes. In other words, their sins are in these huge bags. They're just piling sin upon sin. And they're carrying it either on their back or dragging it with these ropes of falsehood, dragging it with ropes of lies. Oh, they are. That's the next part of it. If you look down in verse 19, it says, you know, now what do they want? They're dragging their ropes dragging their iniquity with cords of falsehood. Who say what? Let him make speed. They're telling God, come on, if you're going to do something, come on and do it. We want to see what you're going to do now. We want you to, instead of trembling at the coming judgment of God, which Isaiah is pronouncing upon them, they pretend to desire its immediate arrival. They want to see it. We want to see it now. We don't want to wait. We want to see it now. They walk by sight, not by faith. And so in doing so, their pretended desire, there is intrinsic to that an incredulity. They, as Isaiah says, you know, they counsel or they purpose, you know, that God will show himself. You know, they want God to show himself holy and righteous, but they want him to do that now. They want the Holy One of Israel to come now. Draw near, come to pass that we may know about it. And so they have their own agenda. Not only are they not concerned about the pile of sin that they're dragging along behind, but they want God to answer. They want God to be present right now so that they can find out, so that they can say, you know, let him make speed. Let him make haste in his work. If you're going to do this, go ahead and do it. We haven't seen any sign of you doing this, so come on and do this. And there's absolutely that impetus of them wanting to have that now. The next woe is a fairly easy one, because as I read this, I don't know about you, but I can't help but think about today's world. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. The fourth woe, glossing over evil, saying that there's nothing wrong with evil, with something that is very clearly evil. Your truth is relative. Your truth is not my truth. They're calling evil good, and they're calling good evil. How many examples could we use? From the house of Israel, from this time of Isaiah, from the time prior to this, even up to this present good hour. Each of you could probably tell me something that you saw within the last week, or heard within the last week, or saw on television within the last week. Someone calling evil good. Someone calling good evil. It seems like the world is completely out of kilter. It's completely out of order. The things that we once knew as being good are now being called evil. The things that we have known forever as being evil are now being called good. has not changed. People are glossing over their evil deeds. They're calling cowardice caution and rashness courage. They're calling people who save thriftless and wasteful profusion generosity. They call evil good. And they call meekness want of proper spirit. Sincerity they call rudeness. Firmness they call obstinacy. There is no moral distinction for them. It is nothing in their eyes but corrupt. Woe to those, verse 21, woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. What is this the sin of? If you're wise in your own eyes, what is the sin? Pride? Conceit? Conceit? What?
See what you want to see.
So conceit is the opposite of what? What's the opposite of conceit? Humility. Conceit is the opposite of humility. And so we see that humility, while it is a crowning virtue, conceit is the finishing touch that you put on vice. Sure. The fear of the Lord is the what? The beginning of wisdom. But these people don't fear. They're not thinking about being humble. They're not thinking about humility. They're thinking about themselves and looking at others and judging others. When one is wise in his own eyes, he sees no reason to change. Woe to those, verse 22. Woe to those who are heroes. Woe to those who are heroes in drinking wine and valiant men in mixing strong drink, who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away the rights of the ones who are in the right. Therefore, as a tongue of fire consumes stubble and dry grass collapses into the flame, so their root will become like rot and their blossom blow away as dust. For they have rejected the law of the Lord of hosts and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. On this account, the anger of the Lord has burned against them and his people, and he has stretched out his hand against them and struck them down. And the mountain quaked, and their corpses lay like refuse in the middle of the streets. For all this his anger is not spent, but his hand is still stretched out. So the final woe is talking again about drink, strong drink. What's the difference, though, between the first drinking strong drink and this one, and this drinking strong drink? What do these people do that the first ones don't? The first ones do what? They drink and they party. What do these people do? They drink and then they do what? They take bribes. They go to work. They issue judgments against others while they're drinking strong drink. They're issuing judgments against other people. They're taking bribes. So they're doing business in this state as opposed to just partying like the first group were. Drunkenness not being bad enough on all the things that it leads to, but then also now they're drinking and now they're trying to conduct some kind of business. They're justify the wicked for a bribe. They take away the rights of the ones who are in the right. So their judgment is so clouded by the strong drink that they make judgments against people who are right. And so then in verse 24, he talks about the fact that a general judgment now is going to be pronounced on them. Given these six woes, there's now going to be a general judgment. What does the judgment look like? As I read verse 24, I thought a lot about the fires that I've seen, not only in California, but in other places where dry grass burns. And everyone can get that picture in their mind of a field being burned. And how the fire consumes everything in its path. The dry grass collapses into the flame. And so for these people, they will rot and their blossom will blow away in the sun, for they've rejected the law. And so now in verse 25, on down through the remainder of the chapter, he talks about how he's going to stretch his hand out. The Lord is going to stretch his hand out against the people. He's going to strike them down. It's coming. It's coming in the form of Pul, P-U-L, the ruler that will first invade their lands. It will come in the form of Sennacherib. It will come in the form of Shalmaneser. It will come in the form of kings of Egypt that will come down. This is a portent or a vision of what's coming. And the mountains quake, the corpses lie like refuse in the middle of the streets. For all this, his anger is not spent. God has plenty of anger against these people. God is going to bring a judgment against these people. God is going to, his anger is not being extinguished. His anger is not spent. He's got plenty. Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah. He makes that general call. Now he becomes, from a general warning that Brother Raymer talked about, now he makes a very specific warning starting in verse 26 through the remainder of the chapter. He's going to lift up a standard. Now, what is a standard? When you lift up a standard, you're lifting up a what? It's a banner. It's a flag that's waved. He's signaling other countries, it's time. It's time. And now as he raises up these other countries, the specific nature of the coming judgment is then revealed. He's going to lift up this signal. He's going to render in the Hebrew word, it's an ensign or a standard, used by both the Egyptians and the Assyrians. It was a flag that denoted that they were supposed to be ready for the attack. So he's going to lift up a standard to the distant nation, and here possibly talking about Assyria, and will whistle for it from the ends of the earth. And when it talks about the whistling from the end of the earth, there was an interesting note in here. Let me see what it is. Whose Bible has something besides whistle? What does yours have? A hiss. There are versions of the Bible that have this, that he will hiss for it from the ends of the earth. I thought this was extremely interesting. Hissing is said to have been practiced by the beekeepers in that time to draw the bees out of their hives in the morning. So imagine someone who practices apiary, who's an apiarist. He's a beekeeper. And he stands in front of the beehives in the morning and he hisses. And the bees all come out. And at dusk, he stands in front of the beehives and he hisses again and all the bees go back in. God is going to hiss. He's going to call these countries. He's going to call these countries to them. He will also lift up a standard to the distant nation, and he will hiss for it from the ends of the earth. And behold, it will come with speed swiftly. These are large armies, chariot-driven armies, whose primary weapons of attack are the bow and the arrow. The Assyrians. No one in it is weary or stumbles. The army is not tired as it comes upon them. The army is ready for battle. Those who come upon the house of Judah and Jerusalem are not tired. They are not weary. They don't slumber, nor do they sleep. Nor is the belt at its waist undone, nor its sandal strap broken. They are ready to consume the nation. And their arrows are sharp. And all their bows are bent. The hooves of their horses seem like flint, and their chariot wheels like a whirlwind. There is evidence in the scripture that, especially Sennacherib, their wheels are like whirlwinds. Sennacherib in Isaiah 37, verse 24, talks about the fact that he boasts of his multitude of chariots, and the sculptures from that time and the inscriptions in the Assyrian archaeological ruins that have been found show that the chariot was a mighty and very formidable attack mechanism for routing people who did not have the horse, who did not have chariots themselves. It's roaring, verse 29. It's roaring is like a lioness. Why is a lioness as opposed to a lion? I'm sorry? The lioness is the hunter. But she is also considered by the Hebrews to be more fierce than the lion. Yours says lion? Yeah. Now the original Hebrew, the word is lioness as I see it here. And it roars like a young lion. Yeah. Yeah. And so it growls as it seizes its prey. And you know, if you've watched any documentaries on the Serengeti and hunting lions, Andy is correct that the lioness does most of the hunting. And she fiercely protects her cubs. And so the roaring of the lioness, the roar like a young lion, it growls as it seizes its prey and carries it off with no one to deliver it. And it shall growl over it in that day like the roaring of the sea. If one looks to the land, behold, there is darkness and distress. Even the light is darkened by the clouds. Verse 30 basically is talking about the fact that once these people are consumed, once these people are captured by the Assyrians, by the lions, once they're taken hold of the lions, and Sennacherib talks about that in one of his inscriptions at Nineveh, Sennacherib says that he's carried off out of Jerusalem 200,150 captives. Once these captives get to Assyria, and they look back on the land of Judah, and they look back on their homeland, if one looks to the land, it says in verse 30, behold, there is darkness and distress. These people are looking back at their homeland that they've been taken out of, and now they're in captivity. They're looking back at their homeland, and all that they see is darkness and distress, and the light is darkened by the clouds. And so it's pretty grim forewarning of what's to come. Oops. All right. Chapter 6, and I'm not going to be able to spend nearly as much time in chapter 6 as I wanted to, and I went way too much time in that. But hopefully that was informational for you. Chapter 6, verse 1. In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple. 579 BC, King Uzziah died. We don't know if this is early in the year of his death or after his death. We know that this was sometime during the year of King Uzziah's death. So this is, for Isaiah, this is his call. We're 6 chapters deep into the book of Isaiah, and now for the first time we're going to actually look at Isaiah's call from God, his call to prophesy to the people. It comes to him in a vision. It's his vision of the Lord. In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne. All right. Lord here is the translated word Adonai. This is Adonai. You'll find down in verse 5 and in verse 3, the word is Jehovah or Yahweh. Okay, so these are two ways that he talks about the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on the throne. Why do I have a problem with that? What does the Bible tell us about seeing God? No one has seen God and lived. Now there are 3 instances that I can think of, or some, there are probably more, but I can think of some instances where people have seen God. Who saw God? Who's seen God in the Bible? It talks about seeing God. Moses saw God, saw his hindquarters. He put him in the cleft of the rock and he passed by. Micaiah saw God sitting on a throne, much as this. So the vision that Isaiah is seeing is not of, he is seeing the Lord. Yes, he is. He is seeing the Lord. But we can't, you can't, the Lord does not physically sit on the throne, because God is what? God is spirit. But he sometimes takes human form for someone to see him, for the emphasis that has. Isaiah sees the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple. So how does that make you feel? You're Isaiah. How does that make you feel? Give me some adjectives for how you would feel if you saw this. Small. Huh? In awe. He is undone. If you want to read about a throne, and there are various thrones described in the Bible, go over to 1 Kings chapter 10, verses 18 through 20. And it talks about Solomon's throne. Solomon's throne was perhaps even grander than any of the thrones of the kings of Egypt or the kings of Assyria or the kings of any other time. And this describes his throne. But God is sitting on his throne, lofty and exalted. So he's above everything. Isaiah is looking up at him. The train of his robe, or the robe that he has, fills the temple. And above him, verse 2, above him are the seraphim, standing above him, each having 6 wings. 2 they cover their faces, 2 they cover their feet, and with 2 they fly. All right, tell me why. Tell me what's the implication for these 6 wings. What do the first 2 cover? They cover their eyes. Why do they cover their eyes? Do what? Well, they cover their eyes because they are in the august presence. You are correct. They are in the august presence of God, the creator of the universe. And they feel the same thing Isaiah would feel as he covers his face. He covers his eyes. I'm sorry? Humility and reverence to God? Yes, yes. Why do they cover their feet? Submission. They are angels. These are angels. These are seraphim. Their ministrations are to minister to the people on earth. And when they come to earth, their feet trod the ground. And their feet become dirty with the sin. And God cannot look upon sin. So they cover their feet. They cover their eyes. Out of fear, out of reverence to God, they cover their feet. And with two, they do what? They fly. They're constantly ready to do the bidding of our God. They are constantly at the ready. I sometimes think when I read this of the last two, with two they fly, I think of hummingbirds and that set of wings that they have that allow them to appear motionless as they fly. But they're always ready to dart off. They're always ready to go and do something else. Truly, if you do any research and you read anything about the seraphim, they are the ones who are at above. They are above God, but they are above Him because they are in a position to worship. They are over Him only because they stand ready to do the things that He wants them to do. One called out to the other, chapter 6, verse 3. One calls out to the other and says, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God of hosts. The whole earth is full of His glory." Why holy, holy, holy? Why holy three times? Repetition for what? Infinite repetition of holy, 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 but it also represents the Trinity. Holy God, Holy Son, Holy, Holy, Holy Ghost. And so they cry out, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God of hosts. Holy is the Lord Jehovah, Jehovah. The whole earth is full of His glory." Now, isn't that interesting? We're in heaven. We're seeing a vision of the Lord on His throne. We see the seraphim. What is their primary interest? Glorifying God. But what is their prime focus? What is the focus of everything that they're doing? The whole earth is full of His glory. On the brightest day, you can go out, you can look at the sun, or look toward the sun and feel its warmth. At night, if you live where you can look up to the stars, you can see an infinite number of stars in the heavens. You can be that close to God, or you can lay in your bed at night and hear your heartbeat and be that close to God. The whole earth is full of His glory. Which begs the question, how do you come here to worship? What is your attitude when you come to worship? Does it mean anything to you? Does it mean anything to you at all? That when you come into this assembly, that you are face to face with the Creator of the universe. Should that not affect how we worship? Do the things that happen here, do they touch you in the worship? Do you cry in the worship because of your sin? What attitude do you bring to worship? How holy are you? Holy, holy, holy. Why holy? Why holy? Because that is God's greatest trait. He is separate from all of us because of His holiness. You think you're holy? Do you consider yourself holy when you come to worship? Can you make it through an entire worship service and not have a thought outside of the realm of this building? Do you not think about something during the worship that is not a part of this worship? You have to, because you're human. No one can sit here for the entire hour of worship and focus on what is holy. You can't do it. You can't do it. It's hard as you try. Because you are sinful people. And that is why. Holy, holy, holy. God is holy. His thoughts are not our thoughts. His ways are not our ways. He is so far above us. And for us to come here, we must humble ourselves. If you bring pride in here, if you bring haughtiness, if you bring conceit, if you bring any of the sins that God hates so much in here, your worship cannot be acceptable to Him. You must humble yourself, and you must bring an attitude of humility and subservience to every worship service, because you are face to face. Where two or three are gathered together in my name, there I am. You are face to face with Almighty God. And that should change us. That should change the way we worship. That should change our attitudes about worship. But for some, they just come. They just show up. Now I'm here. I do my hour. I'm going to go to the house. And, you know, I don't know what we're going to have for lunch. Thinking about that halfway through the service. Certainly it does. Certainly it does. Certainly it should. And so the foundations of the thresholds trembled at the voice of him who called out while the temple was filled with smoke. We had a thunderstorm here a few weeks ago. You ever been in a real thunderstorm where it just rattles the whole house? Imagine that. It's rattling the whole house where Isaiah is. It's rattling the whole house. That's God speaking. Was that second bell? We're out of time. I'll come back here next week and we'll pick up there. Look at the Lord willing. We'll continue with his commission next week.